From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Members of the Security Council expressed their concern about the Turkish attack in the north of Syrian territory.
That was Ambassador Rafael Ramirez, Venezuela's permanent representative to the United Nations, and this month, the sitting president of the UN Security Council, speaking after a closed session of the council called by Russia in response to attacks launched by Turkey into Syrian territory.
We received a letter from the Syrian government expresses the concern about this violation, and all members of the Security Council are agree to asking for the Turkish to comply with the international law.
But despite the unanimous council vote calling for Turkey to cease its attacks on Syria in violation of international law, Ankara announced its intention to carve out a slice of Syria approximately 10 kilometers wide, which would include the town of Azaz. Turkey had shelled Syrian Kurdish forces in northern Syria for 4 consecutive days as Ankara tried to stop the Kurds' YPG group from reclaiming the town of Azaz, 8 kilometers from the Turkish border. That shelling was the primary motivator behind Tuesday's unanimous Security Council resolution. Turkey's Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu said Ankara would not allow Azaz to fall to the YPG forces and would render Syria's Minag air base unusable if YPG forces do not retreat from the area. The air base had been held by the so-called Islamic State since August 2013 and was recaptured by YPG forces with Russian air support last week. Meanwhile, the Syrian Red Crescent said that at least 100 trucks full of humanitarian aid set off from Damascus for besieged areas of Syria Wednesday, the latest delivery of supplies to the trapped residents. The UN said after crisis talks in Damascus Tuesday that the Syrian government had approved access to 7 besieged areas. Wednesday's mission came a week ahead of a planned resumption of peace talks between Syria's warring parties. The aid convoys Wednesday headed for Madaya, Zabadani, and Muadamiya al-Sham near Damascus, and to the villages of Al-Fua and Kefraya in Idlib province in the northwest. After Tuesday's unanimous vote at the UN Security Council, Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, Bashar Ja'afari, spoke with the press.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. You have just heard the President of the Security Council, Ambassador Rafael Ramirez, explaining to you that the Security Council held closed consultations with regard to the Turkish aggression against the sovereignty of my country, Syria. You have heard him saying that the members of the council have, all of them, expressed their concerns with regard to this Turkish flagrant violation of the sovereignty of a sovereign member of the United Nations. The members of the council, some of them, went even that far to condemn the Turkish irresponsible behavior towards my country, Syria. But all of the members, including those who have supported and spoiled the Turkish government's policies, wrong policies towards my country, have expressed their concerns with regard to this irresponsible, provocative Turkish behavior. You may remember that we kept sending letter after letter to the Security Council for the last 5 years, drawing the kind attention of the member states about the Turkish government involvement into the domestic affairs of my country, Syria. The Turkish ambassador, the current one and the one before him, kept denying any responsibility of the Turkish government with regard these accusations. Nowadays, even the closest ally of Turkey, meaning the United States, France, Britain, have expressed today their concerns with regard this Turkish escalation represented or translated into military acts, military aggression against my country. We sent a previous letter on the 2nd of February to the members of the Security Council regarding the same kind of Turkish irresponsible behavior. And today we sent another letter. So in only 10 days we sent two letters regarding the Turkish government escalation towards my country. And we ask the Security Council to act appropriately and accordingly in order to hold the Turkish government responsible for this aggressive act in light of the provisions of the Charter in these cases. The Syrian government reserves its rights with regard all kind of compensation, and we hold the Turkish government responsible for all these acts of aggression and escalation towards my country. So the story isn't finished yet. Finally, the Security Council decided to hold closed consultations today, and as I told you, as I have just told you, and as the President of the Security Council has explained to you, there is a kind of unanimity within the Council with regard expressing concerns vis-à-vis this Turkish irresponsible behavior and aggressive act of violation of all kind of international law principles, as well as the provisions of the provisions of the United Nations Charter. We will keep continuing our pressure on the Council to react accordingly, to take concrete measures, to hold the Turkish government responsible for this huge escalation in the area, an escalation that would spread all over the area and would implicate a wider range of war and conflicts in the area in such a way that may threaten the peace and security in our area, not only in our area, but in the whole world. Turkey is trying to pull everybody into this nightmare, into this escalation, so that the Turkish government wouldn't be alone in this deterioration of the situation. Nowadays, everybody knows what's going on in Syria. The Turkish government is responsible of dealing, trading with ISIL, buying oil, gas, and artifacts from ISIL, facilitating the movement of this trade, illegal, illegitimate trade of artifacts and gas and oil through Turkish territory, ending into some European capitals and Israel. So the story is over, the game is over. The Turkish wrong policies and irresponsible policies are very well known to everybody. And it's time to put the Turkish rulers at the seat of confession in front of this Security Council.
In our ongoing review of retail electoral politics in the U.S. during this presidential election year, we had the honor of speaking with BlackAgendaReport.com's Bruce Dixon. We spoke with him via Skype Sunday. Personally, I keep seeing in the introduction of the idea of socialism and a quote-unquote socialist as a candidate into the retail political sphere, sort of an analogy for what happened in 2008, which ended up producing America's first quote-unquote black president. We saw how the Obama presidency brought us AFRICOM and some other things that would have been difficult or impossible for a Republican to accomplish. I'm wondering what a quote-unquote socialist could accomplish if elected.
First of all, I don't think they're really analogous. In 2008, the conversation among black people was anti-ideological on its surface, and it was all about unifying behind this black candidate without asking him any questions, and it was all about suppressing black demands for justice in employment and housing and all the age-old issues that we've been trying to get some justice on, just so we could get a black president. If you were black, you were told to sit down and shut up, because if you voiced your opinions too loudly, white folks might impute those to Barack Obama and not vote for him because of you. And after all, we were told he can't do nothing until he gets up in there. And so I think that we're miles and miles ahead, galaxies ahead, of 2008 in terms of openness to ideas and dialogue. And I don't see the two situations analogous at all. The introduction of socialism, well, I mean, to start with, I'm a socialist. I don't think Bernie is.
Right.
Okay, Bernie generally lets other people call him a socialist, pretty much. Right. And then whenever he does call himself a socialist, he claims he's a democratic socialist, right, with a capital D, not a small D,
right,
a capital D, which means he's a socialist inside the Democratic Party, a socialist who, for instance, never mentions capitalism. How could you be a socialist who's not against capitalism?
Right.
That's kind of hard for me to grasp. Bernie's socialism also stops at the water's edge. Socialists are supposed to stand for working men and women, the poor, not just of their own race and color and creed, but all over the world. Bernie's socialism stops at the water's edge. He's an unabashed supporter of Israel, no matter what they do. We've never heard him criticize the settlements. We've never heard him criticize the occupation. We've never heard him criticize Israeli apartheid. It just does not happen. You know, so it's hard to imagine what kind of socialist this guy is. And while on the one hand, we are happy to hear that, you know, that somebody's not afraid to do this, and we're happy to that people are finally open to engaging with what socialism really is, we're going to have to do some real work after this is over to reclaim it, if we're not careful, from the likes of people like Bernie Sanders, who call themselves socialists, but actually, you know, endorse almost literally every piece of the war machine. If you're going to be a socialist and you're not for slashing the Pentagon budget, how are you going to pay for your jobs programs? How are you going to pay for education? How are you going to pay for mass transit? You know, so, well, that's, I've talked enough. That's it.
The thing that catches my interest on exactly that point is one thing Sanders has been, or as people have been promoting, is the fact that he was involved in the civil rights movement during the 60s, and like everyone tries to wear Dr. King on their lapel, though he actually has some creds there, some, you know, compared to the others in particular. But the statement of Dr. King on exactly that subject is clear, that he saw the Great Society basically go down the tubes in Vietnam because the expenditures for the war there were consuming the resources. How does he not see it here?
Well, that's a question for Bernie, not a question for me, I'm afraid, Don. Next time you interview him, you know, be sure you make that one of the questions.
Yeah, we'll do that. The situation in 2016, of course, is substantially different from 2008, when the economic collapse had just started to unfold as a financial collapse. And although many were already feeling the pain for a good long time, in fact, many for a few hundred years, it really didn't fully manifest until after the election. It has still been manifesting and cooking for 8 years now. Do you think that that has something to do with the different response from the political system to the condition of the people?
It has everything to do with it. And, of course, there's the fact that Hillary is the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party. And, you know, Hillary, and there's almost nobody whose hands are dirtier on just about every front you can imagine than Hillary. Hillary has been, you know, the tool of the oligarchs. The Clintons have been the tool of the oligarchs since forever. You know, so it's, on the one hand, there's a little bit of anybody but Hillary in there. And on the other hand, the stuff that Bernie does say that is absolutely true and correct, that the U.S. economy is structured to benefit the 1%, not the 99%, is true. And then you also have to give a lot of credit to the activists who never stopped, who never stopped during the Bush administration and who never stopped during the Obama administration in trying to get the message out about economic unfairness, economic lack of opportunity, and notably the Occupy movement of 2011, 2012, and 2013. Well, really 2012. And all of these things have combined to give us the context in which right now we've got, you know, we see a Democratic candidate who's actually able to raise some of these issues. In the long run, though, the Democratic Party is not a small d Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is not the creature of its voters. It's the creature of its funders. And its funders are big insurance, Wall Street, big real estate, big agriculture. And the folks who control and run the Democratic Party on behalf of their funders have staved off every insurgent effort against them for the last 10 elections. They also are backed up by corporate media, which can use which can accept unlimited amounts of anonymous cash to run negative ads and misleading ads. And even apart from ads, there's the character of the news coverage itself. All of the big media concerns are owned by one percenters. They're owned by billionaires and by billionaire corporations, and they are absolutely hostile to those parts of Sanders' agenda which have to do with highlighting economic inequality and solving it. So we can expect to be carpet bombed down the line by lots of negative ads, and we can also expect adverse news coverage or no coverage at all when it suits them, or distorted coverage of those messages and what they mean. So the likelihood of Sanders getting the nomination is vanishingly unlikely. Sanders is kind of a gateway drug that makes it okay for some people to still call themselves Democrats. And that's what he is, and that's his job, and that's what he's doing.
So there, you know, there are one of two possible outcomes as far as his candidacy goes. Either he gets the nomination, which it certainly seems to be stacked against him, or for some reason that hasn't manifest yet or hasn't become clear yet, he does get the nomination. If he does, is Wall Street really as afraid of him as one might think, given the precarious situation that the entire financial industry is in, Europe's economy, the entire global capitalist economic system is teetering, and if there were some kind of a major crisis, it could provoke some real militancy among even the American population. Would Sanders seem more useful to them as a vent in that situation as opposed to someone that they fear?
The guys who run Wall Street are just not that flexible. What would they have done if FDR hadn't come along and saved them? What would they have done if Obama hadn't come along and saved them? You know, that flexibility is not really their stock and trade. Arrogance is their stock and trade, and arrogance and impunity. So I just, and they are threatened, like I said, by Sanders' message. So what they will do is they will bombard the media with negative ads and misleading information of all kinds. And of course, there are also the superdelegates, too. The superdelegates in the Democratic Party process are about 15% of the total delegates. How are you going to overcome that? I just don't see it. There's a the first big round of primaries is in 2 weeks, March 1st, Super Tuesday. And then there's a second round of primaries on March 15th. The last primary is June 4th. Early June in California, first week of June in California. And the Democratic convention is not till mid or late August. So the Democratic nominee is usually decided well before the California primaries. So we'll get to see how this plays out. But I view personally the likelihood of a Sanders nomination by the Democratic Party as highly unlikely, vanishingly unlikely.
And then, you know, you mentioned Roosevelt and even Obama as, you know, saviors to the system, certainly. There was union militancy, broad socialist, even strong communist movement in the United States in the aftermath of the Depression, and that had been building even, organizing well before that, but certainly maturing at that point in time. And Roosevelt headed it off successfully by adjusting the economic system here. Sanders is advocating something similar, maybe Roosevelt light. Obama, of course, had the space to prop some of the pieces back up that allowed Wall Street to continue, the stock market to climb, all of that. And they did fight him, you know. I mean, Roosevelt almost faced a coup, for example, and a military coup. And Obama has been looking over his shoulder for sure for quite some time and faced a hostile Congress even when the Democrats controlled it. If Sanders is going to be blocked and you're going to have Hillary Clinton, who is not offering any kind of substantial change to the economic system, and certainly the Republicans are offering nothing more than more deregulation of Wall Street, which leads to another 2008 or maybe deeper, how exactly do they expect to survive?
They're arrogant and they're in power, and they think their rule can last forever. That's what they believe. That's who they are, and that's what they are. It doesn't have to be rational to be real.
Right. So that, of course, puts on the agenda for us what is to be done. If we're looking at an inevitable drive towards a major crisis here, or an increasingly unsustainable crisis, what kind of work should we be doing to meet that when the time comes?
The answer, of course, is revolutionary work. This is a system that hasn't just reached the end of its useful life. It's a system that is killing us. It's a system that is, capitalism is rendering the planet unfit for human habitation, at least on the scale that we've been accustomed to inhabiting it. This situation is not sustainable. But that does not seem to bother the folks who are in charge. So the only option in the end is we've got to have a real set of changes in who runs this part of the world, who runs this world, who makes the economic decisions, and who makes the political decisions. And that, as Mr. Sanders correctly points out, is called a revolution.
In the alternative parties, Jill Stein is leading, or in any event, the most widely publicized candidate of the Green Party. And she ran in 2012, as you well know. And Gloria LaRiva from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. There are others. The Greens are advocating, or at least Stein has been advocating, a Green New Deal. LaRiva, of course, and her party advocating socialism. What role
they play in both the campaign in general, or more specifically, and in general in terms of helping to organize a response by the people to a crisis that seems inevitable?
Okay, well, to answer that sincerely, I got to take off all my, I got to acknowledge all my hats and take them off. Besides working with Black Agenda Report, I've been doing some work for the Stein campaign. But what I'm about to say is not necessarily the opinion of the Stein campaign. I'm also the co-chair of the Georgia Green Party, although what I'm saying about to say now is not necessarily the opinion of the Georgia Green Party. You know, what we need to see is we need parties. We need a party. The left needs a party in this country. It may not in the end be the Green Party. It may be something else down the road. We need a mindset that views elections as for now as incidental to the work of revolution, because they're not going to allow you to vote this kind of a change in. The people that run this society are not going to allow you to vote them out of power. It's just never going to happen. It's never happened before, and it's not going to happen anytime soon. And so we have to view elections as an educational opportunity, an opportunity to get our ideas out in front of people and to do mobilizations. But electoral mobilizations cannot be the goal of the party. Many people inside the Green Party believe that that electoral mobilizations are the goal and the end, and that we should be working to elect green candidates, which I guess we should be working to elect green candidates, but that we should be imagining ourselves taking some kind of national power. And that's just foolish, I think. I think it's utterly foolish, because once again, they're not going to allow us to vote them out of power. Nobody ever has done that ever in history. So we have to have a strategy that actually educates people and builds local power and trains people on the local level in their workplaces, in their communities, to seek and exercise not just political office, but real power over their surroundings. And that is indeed a long-term project, inimical to the view that says that every election we have to go all out and pull all the stops out and use up all our political capital just on that.
You know, you mentioned the role of the media, and of course the nature of it, where it is highly controlled, centrally controlled, a very small number of owners, and very narrow band of opinion that's expressed, even in opposition, through that media. And of course, at Black Agenda Report, you have been very busy there and in prior incarnations in trying to provide and providing alternative information for people to chew on so they have a better understanding of what's happening. And just your Podbean downloads are over a million. You're reaching a lot of folks. What is it that, you know, you have a number of alternative media outlets. What is it that can be done to amplify those voices to try to reach more people?
That is a question that really needs study and investigation. And we don't really have the answer. I mean, although we're out there, and we'll be out there 10 years this year, and there are a number of places, most people still get their information from TV. That's the fact. The media outlets that are owned and operated by the billionaires are where people go to get their information, not Black Agenda Report, not Counterspin, not Fair.org, not those sorts of places. So we really need to pay a lot more attention to how to get our ideas out and how to empower local media and responsible media. And it's just a question that we are behind the curve on, and it just needs work.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.